I'd like to welcome today Michael Hamilton Morgan. He's the author of the book Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. Why did you write this book?
Well, it's a culmination of a long process of discovery. My second language is Spanish. I studied Spanish literature, among other things, and was aware of this long interlude in Spanish history. It was not presented in a very deep or, I think, accurate way, the Moorish period in Spain, which was 786 years. Then after 9/11 and then the U.S. interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq, I felt like Americans in particular weren't operating from a really deep understanding of the cultures that they were inserting themselves in a military way. Our context was basically the headlines of the morning, which were the latest terrorist bombing or some other terrible event, and it was essentially defining a whole culture for us. So I think that's what pulled me into this.
You say somewhere that we have a clash, but it's not a clash of civilizations, and I think that's sort of the foundation of your book.
Well, that's right. My argument is that there are clashes of groups, there are clashes of political groups and interest groups and so on. But I think when you look at the definition of civilization, the civilization that we inhabit now is digital. Whether you live in Saudi Arabia or Santa Fe or New York, electronics and that whole world drives what we do. And my argument is that the foundation of that are the higher mathematics that were developed in Baghdad and Cairo and Cordoba and Damascus more than 1,000 years ago, primarily but not exclusively by Muslim thinkers or Muslim patronized thinkers.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute because we were going to be talking about math. But let's back up. What is the time span and the geographical span that you're covering in your book, Lost History?
Well, it's probably too much. It's too wide, too broad, but we cover from the time of the Prophet Muhammad, which is in the 7th century current era, until about 1800, which is the end of the Mughal Empire in India, the British occupation, and when it becomes a colonial holding of the British Empire. So it's a long sweep, and it covers all the way from way out in Central Asia and including China, which has its Muslim period under the Khans, Genghis and his descendants, not well remembered in China, I might add, all the way into, Spain and then some echoes here in the United States. So it's a huge chunk. Some friends of mine tease me about having written 1,001 greatest hits of Islam. I should add, it's not about the religion per se, just how the religion impacted on the shaping of a culture.
So how did the religion impact on the shaping of a culture? I mean, as you say, it's not primarily a religious set of ideas that we're talking about. In fact, many of them are science and math.
That's right. Well, I highlight some of the very uncanny statements that come from the prophet himself. If you're a Muslim, you believe they're the word of God. If not, they're his statements that deal with things like the orbits of the planets, about human reproduction, about numbers and so on that are very uncanny and which were used to give permission to thinkers to do the kind of work they did. There was always a continuing argument going on from the birth of Islam forward, just like Christendom or other major religions, about the proper role of logic and rationalism and thought versus textual literalism, what we might call fundamentalism now. This was going on from the very beginning. But for a long time, the, quote, rationalists held the levers of powers, and they spent the money on patronage. They created the intellectual centers where all this work was done. But my book shows that some of the permission to do this comes from sacred text. I won't go any further than that because I'm not a Muslim.
Well, hang on. You're opening up a very interesting box there. Let's go into it at least a little bit.
Sure.
Sacred texts giving a basis for rationalism scientific, logical rationalism?
Well, there's a statement that I was unaware of because my background is not in Islamic studies, but there's a statement in the Quran, "The ink of the scholar is holier than the blood of the martyr." Now, this is only one of numerous statements about the beauty of knowledge, the importance of knowledge, of acquiring knowledge, that it's a divine act to learn about the world. And then later, the prophet says, not in the Quran, but I think in one of his sermons, he says, even if you must go to China, seek knowledge. So these sort of drive a religion of intellect that is not as widely known now, and certainly in Islam. It's known by scholars, but what we read about in the newspapers doesn't really jive with what I was reading about 1,000 years ago.
So let's talk about the mathematical part
sure.
of it. The concept zero, which we take for granted,
right.
was actually a what would you say, an invention or a discovery?
Well, it was a discovery, and it was a parallel discovery. I'm told that the Mayas had found the zero. The Mayas were very abstract thinkers, but because they were so geographically isolated, the impact of that discovery didn't go much beyond the Maya area in Central America. The Indians in India had discovered the zero and hadn't done very much with it. They'd also discovered negative numbers, but a great a Persian mathematician who had been recruited by the caliph in Baghdad to come work for him in the 9th century current era was thumbing through these old Indian texts that had been brought up to Baghdad, and he found the concept of the zero, of negative numbers, and also a system of writing numbers that very similar to the ones that we use today. Our system is directly descended from that. We call them Arabic numerals. In fact, they were, I guess, Hindu or Indian numerals that were adopted by the Muslims and built into a complex system of higher math, which, you know, today drives our digital world. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Well, not quite, because the question about zero.
Yes, zero.
It's a big one.
All right. What we're talking about here is going from the Greco-Roman mathematical concept, which was based on geometry, spaces, angles, and all that, very high thinking there, but it only went so far, and it was tied to geo. Geo means earth. It's measuring the earth. Then you get into, with zero and negative numerals and so on, Mr. Al-Khwarizmi was able to create a system of finding lost quantities. This is pure abstraction, and he called it al-jabr, which is restoring, and that is what we know today as algebra. It's the underpinning of all higher math, trigonometry and algorithms, which are named after Mr. Al-Khwarizmi. We don't know that.
So algebra and algorithms
yes.
both start with al,
right.
and they're both Arabic
That's right.
derived
yeah.
names. And very interesting.
But as far as the zero, one of my editors said, what was the world like without zero? And I couldn't describe it. All I know is that if you have zero and negative, then you have the concept of numbers blows out into the infinite, and they weren't there yet with Greek geometry. Now all sorts of doors are opening up if it's not just a limited positive space, if it goes all the way or out into on either end.
So,
but I don't know. I can't conceive of what it is like to not know what zero is. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, it's like trying to imagine not having eyesight
yeah,
when
right,
you've had it. But
right.
at the same time, one can also imagine a world in which geometry, measuring of the earth,
right.
had in its very essence a kind of finitude,
right.
whereas zero and negative numbers led to a level of abstraction that led to even the concept
right.
of infinity and the concept of imaginary numbers and things like that.
It just goes off into pure headwork. And when you read about what these people were doing in the various thought centers in Cairo or Baghdad or Cordoba or Seville or wherever, they're doing this quite often with pen and paper and they did have paper long before Europe was using it. They got it from the Chinese. Sort of blackboard kinds of things, or just scratching out formula in the dirt. We're talking about mathematical formulae that you and I mean, I don't know your background, but I would imagine you're not a math PhD. I'm certainly not. We can't do them. They were doing them 1,200 years, just these incredible number games and competitions. But they really believed that there was a code to the universe that they could unlock. They believed that that code was the representation of God, and that if they didn't know what it was, it was infinitely complex, but they wanted to gradually reveal it.
We're talking to Michael Morgan, author of the book Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists. You also write about the philosopher who came up with an early version of relativity,
which
we think of as a 20th century discovery.
That's right. He had a concept of relativity. And don't ask me to explain Einstein's concept because I can't. But he verbalized a similar concept, but he couldn't prove it. It was an intuitive statement that he made around 850 current era. And there's a lot of argument about whether he was onto it or not, but he used the same term, and he used some of the same concepts of mass and movement, but he couldn't prove it mathematically like Einstein could.
There's also something which I found very interesting, which was the extensive study and understanding and practice of medical science, and that it was on a scientific basis. And there was there were all sorts of surgery. I mean, you can name better than I can what the various medical practices were that people did, and also when they started doing them.
Well, it's just phenomenal. If it were only mathematics alone, it would merit rewriting our history. But then you have these disciplines like medicine, and in part this derives from some of the same statements in sacred text. The prophet had spoken about the necessity to do quarantines when there was some sort of an epidemic moving through Arabia. And he had a very sort of matter-of-fact approach to medicine in the Quran. It was sort of – it didn't have the sin and demons baggage that European Christianity did until the Renaissance. For the other than the Byzantines, who were also intellectually advanced – the European Christians were mired in a very primitive view of the body and what's going on there. But the Muslims didn't have that.
Yeah, the Christian idea that your sins or your demons were causing
right.
your illness, which I have to say, that may have gone out of favor in the Renaissance, but you still hear it in Santa Fe,
oh, yeah.
where people are saying that your angry thoughts caused your illness.
Well, now that you just hit on something, because one of the greats of Muslim medicine is known to us. His Latinized name is Avicenna. And if there's any name from that period that I would say that people might raise their hands in recognition, it would be that. He had more influence on European medicine than anyone else until probably the 16th century. But he came upon the concept of mind-body connection in illness. And this is about in the 11th century. He lived in Persia. He did some early forms of talk therapy, what we would call psychotherapy. He wasn't the first to do it, but he developed it more fully. So he did subscribe to the mind-body connection, but he never talked about demons or curses or anything like that. But he believed that there was some linkage there. And there are a number of cases where he talked people out. There was one, a young man who was wasting away, and through a series of talk sessions, he was able to deduce that this young man had a bad case of unrequited love, and he just needed to go act on it, and maybe he would luck out, and he did, and he won the woman, and he got better. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like common sense now, but as far as other things, for example, there are accounts of hospitals and pharmacies appearing as early as the 8th century in Baghdad, Damascus, and North Africa and Morocco. The concept of the pharmacy is, I think, uniquely Muslim. It didn't exist anywhere else, and it gradually came into Europe, primarily, I think, through Italy, through Venice and the traders there. Venice was kind of an open city. Some of the other heavyweights of Muslim medicine, there was a Spanish Arab Muslim, Al-Zarawi, who lived in Cordoba and is credited with inventing about 200 medical devices, some of which are still in use today, like the obstetrical forceps, sutures. He and Avicenna both used inhalation anesthesia. Avicenna used poppies, I think, which is morphine or opium to sedate people before surgery. I'm not sure what Al-Zarawi was using. They were using alcohol, an Arabic word, an Arab invention.
And so if they were using alcohol, they had germ theory.
Yeah, well, they couldn't see a germ, but they were intuiting that there were some agent there doing it. They inherited a Roman. You remember Galen was the sort of the Galen and Hippocrates we remember, and we honor them. But there's a big space between those two and what we have today, and Galen was into this theory of humors. I mean, moist, dry, so on and so forth. And the Arabs gradually overthrew that because they could find no – they were into questioning and into empirical experimentation, proving things in the laboratory, which is an important intellectual breakthrough. It wasn't faith-based. It was fact-based, reality-based.
And that's what we think of as the European Enlightenment and Renaissance.
Right. When it is, but it wasn't – it didn't happen there first. There was some of it in Greece and Rome. And then the Muslim, the golden ages of Islam brought it to a higher level. And then through Muslim Spain and Muslim Sicily and through the Crusaders returning, through trade, through Italy and so on, all this stuff filtered up.
You talk about a golden age. What time period are we talking about, and where were the flowers of this golden age?
Well, there are many of them, but the one that the conventional – when you talk about the Arab Golden Age, you're talking about the Baghdad and to a lesser extent Cordoba. But we're talking about in Baghdad from 756 current era until the destruction of Baghdad by Genghis Khan's grandson in 1258 current era. So that's almost 500 years, around 500, yeah.
That's 500 years. And during these 500 years, were there texts written that still exist that have come down to us?
Well, initially, no. Some filtered through into Latin. Some were hidden until recently, and some have been lost forever. But there's enough there to create a pretty compelling picture of a culture of genius. Now, that's just one golden age. I would call, you know, Mughal India, the Muslim rule period in India, as another one. Not so much focused on intellect as architecture and literature and so on. Persia, you're really hard to confine in time. Persia is an ancient great civilization with a lot of smart people, and the Muslim period in Persia starts in the 8th century current era. There are multiple rises and falls within what we call Persia. Then Central Asia, Tamerlane or Timurid culture, that's centered in Samarkand out in, I guess that's in Uzbekistan now. And they have about 100 years when that's kind of the center of the world, when Timur the Great is conquering. I mean, he goes all the way from Moscow to India to into the Middle East and towards China.
What literature and poetry have come down to us, and what is their influence in the world outside of Muslim culture?
Well, the poetry... you know, Arabic, as well as Persia and India, are poetry-based cultures. Poetry for those cultures for a long time occupied the role not only of art but of journalism. There would be poetry competitions in which political poets would stand up and argue with one another about – in rhyme or whether – about who was the greatest leader, their patron or the other guys. And they were really phenomenal, and people got killed at these things. But it's a culture of the sound of language that I feel that in some ways we're losing here in the United States. Shakespearean English and all that, we inherit that, and it's a rich and wonderful language. But I feel with our techno culture, we're getting further and further away. And poets have a real hard time in the United States, as you well know. But back then in these places, poets are like, what would I compare them to? They're beyond our own authors. They're, I mean, beyond Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. They're something else.
They're like our Bob Dylan or
– Yes. Yes, exactly. And so the poetry isn't only confined to non-musical forms. It starts to filter into music. So poetry leads into music, and I'll get into that in a moment. But the problem with Arabic poetry is that – even though if you're an Arabic speaker, it's just cosmic and uplifting and wonderful and mystical and so on, it doesn't translate well. And so the literal Arabic poetry doesn't come across too well. But there is an Arabic love poem form. There are both erotic poems and higher chivalric love poems that come with the Arabs into Spain and then up into France and give rise to what we know as the troubadours and then to the modern love song. Not that it might have developed on its own in this culture, but there seems to be a lot of evidence that the infusion of the chivalric love of women and singing to them comes from down south and from another religion, which is an interesting, really interesting path. I'd love to go further into that someday if I had more time.
It seems that music and poetry as journalism, as news, is universal. I mean, this is something that you see in South America and in the Caribbean. This is something you see in troubadour poetry. I mean, in the absence of mass communications, how did people get their news? Somebody went from one place to
That's
the other.
Right.
How do you remember it? You put it in song form.
Well, there are Gabriel Cabrera Infante, a Cuban novelist, has theorized that the flamenco form, he says the word flamenco, which I thought was a Spanish-derived form, well, it comes from two Arabic terms, felamingu, which means country vagabonds. After the Inquisition, you know, Jews and Muslims had the option of either converting or getting out of Spain or being killed. And so some of them went underground and joined the gypsies. And so this hybrid I went to see Maria Benitez last week with my kids, and listening to the music and watching it, I was like, this is really, really – I mean, it's a hybrid form, but it has a really strong Arabic influence here, especially the vocals and the falling minor notes. He's also – I think Cabrera Infante pointed to a number of Latin American musical forms, the cueca, which I think is Chilean, and I don't know if samba or not, because that's got a lot of African influence. But he sees the roots of this Arabic poetic musical form coming into Latin America.
Well, that's another thing that I wanted to get into with you. Spain, being such a heavily Muslim-influenced place, inevitably has influenced not only the New World in general, but New Mexico in specific.
Sure, sure. Well, in when I do my talks around the country, I say that I come from the most culturally Islamic state in the United States, and everybody sort of sits up in their chairs, another one of these. But I think partly because of the historic isolation of New Mexico, it has preserved more of its old immediate post-Inquisition forms than say California or Texas. You can see it in the arches in St. Francis Cathedral, which are officially known as Romanesque arches. Those are Islamo-Romanesque or Syriac Romanesque arches from Damascus. That's because the first real ruling family, Muslim ruling family in Spain, in Al-Andalus, came from Syria and tried to recreate Syria in Spain. Here in New Mexico, the name of our largest city is Albuquerque. Don't really think about it often, but in fact, that's an Arabic-derived name from a North African noble. Go ahead.
Now, should we when you see the beginning of a word AL, is that a flag for you?
It is. It's because you got to be careful sometimes because some of the Visigothic names and words also like Alaric. And some of those old Gothic names start in Alfred, start with A-L. So you can't be universally, but in general.
Alabama.
Right, exactly. I guess that's a Native American derivative name.
Yeah.
I don't know. But Al is the Arabic article, as I understand it, meaning the, like L in Spanish. So, you know.
And so Albuquerque is derived from an Arabic family.
And then, of course, the acequias, which are so important to the irrigation and to the way land is divided here and passed down. Those are my research tells me that the first acequias came from Persia and then were brought over into Syria. And then when the Syrian Umayyad family took over Spain, they brought that into Spain. And then the conquistadores brought it with them. So it's really originally from Persia, but go over there and see Acequia Madre and think, well, this came from Persia.
What are some other Muslim roots that you see here in New Mexico? Are there linguistic? There are some obviously linguistic roots in Spain. What are some in Spanish? What are some others?
I don't go into this much in the book, and I'd probably have to do some more research to give you a really wonderful answer on that. But I think probably the greatest influence would be the family heritage that is probably lost. I think the Inquisition is like a wall, and I think it's very difficult for someone named Benalcázar or something like that to find out what it was before, who they were. Not everybody in Muslim Spain was Muslim. It was a tri-religious, tri-cultural, just like New Mexico is. The power structure for the first 300-400 years was primarily Muslim, but then it began to diversify, and they sort of coexisted for a long stretch until the Catholic kings from Castile became dominant. But I think that would be the area that would be really interesting, kind of a roots project to go back beyond the Inquisition to see who we are, where we come from.
We're talking to Michael Morgan, author of Lost History, The Enduring Legacy of Muslim Scientists, Thinkers, and Artists. You admit yourself, have painted a very broad picture, and you use the tools of fiction in doing so. You really bring us to the time and place. I'd love to hear about some of the characters whom you talk about. There's one I was struck by named Saladin.
Well, Saladin, I think Americans may have heard the name, and he is. We know him from the Crusades. The Crusades were about 9 major and 7 lesser military campaigns engineered from Europe to try and take back the Middle East from Muslim control. And they started around the late 900s, current era, and basically peter out in the 1200s. But Saladin is a Kurd. He is a leader of a group that overthrows a Shiite dynasty in Cairo. This is all very esoteric stuff. But the Shiite-Sunni squabble goes back a long time. It hasn't always expressed itself violently, but it has at times, like in Baghdad today. And he unites the Arab groups who are squabbling, and he overthrows the Shiite dynasty in Cairo and reestablishes Sunni control. But he continues the Shiite tradition of higher learning and research and tolerance and so on, even though he overthrows their control. And he gradually rolls back the Crusaders, and retakes Jerusalem in about 1176 or something like that. And the Crusaders have been in control of Jerusalem for about 100 years, so they've gotten very comfortable there. Some of them have intermarried with Arab women. They've created sort of like plantations and estates nearby. They're leading a very good life. They don't want to go back to France because they're much better off in Jerusalem and in the Palestine or whatever you want to call that area, Syria, than they were back home. And Saladin unites the Arabs and takes back Jerusalem. Now, when the Crusaders had come in, they killed up to 100,000 Muslims, Christians, and Jews who happened to be in the line of fire, and it was just a bloodbath. This is according to European accounts, not Muslim accounts. These are Frankish accounts of how bloody their own conquest was. And so when Saladin retakes the city, everybody thinks, well, he's entitled to do to the Crusaders what they did to our people. But he's got 100,000 Christian prisoners there, including women and children and all sorts of, you know, folks, and he says, you can pay a departure tax and I'll let you all go, which is very magnanimous of him. You know, he could have chopped people's heads off and so on, which was perfectly accepted in that time. And instead, he wants to be, you know, a good guy, and so he lets people pay their tax. But there's still about 30,000 people left who can't pay their tax. They don't have anything. And so his advisors say, well, you can finish them off. And he says, no, I gave them my word that they could leave. I'm paying out of my own pocket. He impoverishes himself. This is true. This is not a fairy tale. He wipes himself out financially to let all those people go when there are some amongst the Christian community who are so wealthy they could have done it 10 times over. He lets them take all their loot and go. Now, Richard the Lionhearted is so impressed with this that he starts this sort of mutual admiration society. In fact, on the battlefield, when Richard loses his horse and it could easily be cut down by the Muslim cavalry, Saladin gives him a new horse. When Richard is sick, Saladin sends his personal physician, who is a wonderful Jewish philosopher, doctor named Maimonides, Musa bin Maimun was his Arabic name, over to treat Richard and saves him. Richard is so impressed with this Jewish doctor, he said, "Will you come back to England with me?" And he says, "No, I have a better job down here." No Jew in 1100 AD is going to move north of the Pyrenees. I mean, anti-Semitism and poverty are just rife. And that's an interesting side story. But Saladin, Maimonides treats Saladin as well as his heir, who is not nearly as noble, more of a wastrel type, and who has Maimonides developing aphrodisiacs along the lines of Viagra, which is really funny to see how Maimonides finishes his medical career.
Heavens. Nevertheless, this story that you're telling, yeah, about a really magnanimous, you know, which means great-souled, yeah, human being, is quite an example for a leader, for essentially a politician or military leader.
And actually, Dante Alighieri, the greatest medieval Italian poet, includes Saladin in
the Divine Comedy.
Yes, exactly, and creates a special category for Saladin. You know, Dante's Catholic, he's Christian and pretty devout. So just about everybody who's in heaven or is a Christian, I don't think any pagans or non-believers make it into his paradiso, but he puts Saladin in a special category for great-hearted souls, which is really a tribute from an Italian in that time and day.
Let's talk about the whole question of tolerance. You are painting a picture, and again, you know, it's such a huge historical time span that I can't fully grasp it. But you're bringing up examples of tolerance and non-racism.
Sure.
Were those individual great-souled people, or was this institutionalized? Was it part of the culture, the religion? What's going on with that?
Well, the tolerance, the religious tolerance, derives from the prophet who had a special affinity or affection or admiration for the two other Abrahamic religions, Judaism and Christianity. And he said on multiple occasions that they should be protected because they were people of the book. He was very respectful of the fact that they had holy texts. He wasn't as respectful of Zoroastrians or, you know, Hindus, Buddhists, and so on, but he was about those two. So Christians and Jews could maintain their own faith if they paid a poll tax, a head tax. This exempted them from military service, but they couldn't build a mosque or a synagogue or a cathedral that was taller than a mosque. They couldn't openly proselytize. They were second-class citizens, but they were protected, and it was a better deal than being slaughtered, I think. So, you know, that's where that starts. There's much argument and debate about, you know, statements about Jews and Christians in the Quran and so on. You have to be able to speak Arabic and know the context of the times to really adequately understand that. But that's the tolerance issue. There was another piece to your question. What was the other one?
Non-racism.
Non-racism. His farewell sermon, Muhammad's farewell sermon as it is recorded, he says something to the effect, and I quote exactly in the book, it's, "Arabs are not better than non-Arabs. Blacks or whites are no better than blacks, and vice versa. The only thing that sets a person apart is their quality of faith." And that has provided sort of a beacon for a lot of people of color who've come to Islam. You know, one of the fastest growing communities is in South Africa, and this dates back before apartheid, I think. And of course, the Nation of Islam in the United States, black Muslims, they, because of this explicit statement of anti-racism, they're drawn to it. So those two things derive from long ago and have been applied or not applied to varying degrees. And then now, you know, most of the coverage that you read is about intolerance and so on. But historically, that's really not been the case until I think a lot of it comes from the issues surrounding the creation of Israel.
Let's talk about the lost part of lost history,
yes.
Because as you're saying, much or most of this is unknown even to very well-educated
sure.
Americans and Europeans.
The history of the transmission starts a few hundred years after a lot of these breakthroughs happen, but there's a very dedicated group of Catholic and Jewish scholar interpreters who start to bring this, the math, the science, the medicine, the philosophy, and so on, into Latin and from then into the vernacular European languages. This starts around 1000 AD. One of the the greatest translator would be Gerard of Cremona. There's some others. A Jewish translator, I think, was Savasorda. There's Adelard of Bath, also known as Abelard of Bath. And these are all medieval Catholic or Jewish scholars who learn Arabic, some of them from scratch. And it's not like they're born into an Arabic-speaking family or anything. They do it the hard way and start to translate text by text what they can get their hands on. They are spurred on by this phenomenal figure that I've discovered. I'd never heard of him. Catholic Pope Sylvester II, who was only pope for about 6 years at the turn of the millennium, the first millennium, from about 998 to 1004. He had done his early religious studies in Spain and was well aware of the intellectual accomplishments of that culture. And he's the one who introduced Arabic numerals into the Catholic Church and dumped the Roman numerals, which were really kind of useless. I mean, they're good for carving into the front of a temple or something, but not really for
doing calculations.
Right, exactly. And this guy, Sylvester II, didn't rule in Rome. He ruled in Avignon when there was a period when the Pope said, I don't know, there was some schism or fight and they were up in France. But he spurred a lot of the intake and made it sort of politically correct to start bringing this Muslim stuff into Western Christian culture. He was accused of being a Satanist. He was called the Muslim Pope by his detractors. I need to find out more about this guy and how he met his end. But there was a group who was really against what he was doing. I mean, we've had these squabbles about knowledge have been going on since the beginning of time. Then the treasure house of Al-Andalus, these great libraries in Cordoba and so on, I guess one of the greatest crimes of the Inquisition is that they were burned. Archbishop Jimenez, whether on his own or at the direction of his royal patrons, burned everything they could find. They were talking several million volumes when at the time in Europe, by 1500, European libraries were coming up to par, but these libraries dated back 800 years when there was no such thing in north of the Pyrenees. So we lost all those. Genghis and his grandsons did a lot of burning in Persia and Baghdad and so on, but enough stuff survived, some of it just now coming to light, that we're starting to fill in. It's kind of like those pictures from deep space, composite pictures. Here's a little chunk here and then trying to fill in the space between. But there's also an old cliche called history is written by the winners. And for the last 500 years, the Muslim world has kind of been on a steady losing streak politically and militarily. And a lot of the Muslim world went under British or European colonialism.
So a lot was lost in the burning of libraries and through political history and so on. So in places that, you know, like Baghdad, I mean, there was a tremendous library there that was destroyed right at the beginning of this most recent war. But are Muslim scholars and, you know, ordinary Muslim people aware of the material that's in your book, Lost History?
I think that most of them may have heard some of the names, but they do not know the intellectual implications of who these people were and what they did. When I was in the Persian Gulf in the spring, and I saw chain of pharmacies, you know, named after Avicenna. So, you know, the names echo around. I think the airport in Baghdad was named after the first man to do glider flight, Ibn Firnas, in Spain in 875, current era. So the names are around, but I think it's like, you know, if you go to Washington, D.C. and a kid on the street sees a statue of Lafayette, does he know what Lafayette did? Probably not. Not the typical American kid. That was what originally drew me to this project, was to try and show young Muslims what their history was about. But then when I got into it, I realized this is our history. It's not just theirs.
Your goal was to show young Muslims?
Yeah, I originally went into it. I have a nonprofit that is trying to do that in certain Muslim countries. And I've gotten a lot of interest and support, not enough financial support, but moral support, people saying, oh, we need to know this. We need to know what these people did, what they were about. They're great thinkers.
So what has been the trajectory of this work and of your book so far? You've been speaking all over the place.
Yeah, well, I was on Al Jazeera 6 times, so I'm kind of a hit with American and overseas Muslims, getting a lot of speaking invites and so on. As far as mainstream readers, I'm not there yet. It's still early. The book's been out for just, I guess, about 8 weeks. But I need to reach – if I don't reach mainstream readers, I think
in
I
the
will
United
fail.
States.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There is an Arabic translation in the works. That'll be out next year. And I'm hoping we'll get some European languages like French and German. I mean, the intercultural issues of Islam and not Islam are really – in the forefront in Europe.
Where do these stereotypes of Islamic terrorism come from? Are they just simply the last, you know, the most recent years and maybe a couple of decades?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. And I don't know how I come down on this yet. Obviously, Al-Qaeda exists and they do these things and they're imitators and fellow travelers and so on. Bernard Lewis, who is a very esteemed but now increasingly I think neoconservative scholar believes he finds a tradition of assassination and so on. I think he had a book out some years ago after it was called The Assassins, and that's the name given to a particular group. It was a Shiite group that was resisting the Sunni orthodoxy in Syria and so on. But what I think is it's just an unfortunate confluence of everyday headlines and any lack of any context to put it in, so that, you know, a suicide bomber is going to blow everybody literally and blow everybody else off the media kind of radar because it's so sensational and unbelievable and brutal and human. And when you don't have any broader context to put it in, then the whole culture is defined by that.
It's just about time to go. Is there anything that you want to leave our listeners with today?
Well, I just want to close by saying that, of course, I hope everybody, whether you buy it or go to the library, have a look at this book. But really to give some really deep thought to our idea of who we are and where we come from. Because I think if you really look into that, you find out that there's a lot more to the story than the conventional history that we've been given.
Michael Morgan, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much, Mary Charlotte.